This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Robin Blotnick and Rachel Lears. They are co-producers and co-directors of the film The Hand That Feeds, which is screening this coming Saturday at 11 o'clock at the CCA. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks.
So this film follows the work lives of immigrants who are working in New York in a place called Hot and Crusty. It's like a little restaurant. It's kind of a fast food place, very popular in New York City, where when the movie opens, employees are working for less than the minimum wage. They're not getting overtime. They're working in dangerous working conditions, broken equipment, and they're really disrespected. And they start organizing. And this is what's so interesting, I think, to me and to so many people who are looking at these kinds of issues, is it focuses on the kind of organizing that's going on in the absence of strong unions and during a period of real decline of strong unions. What's going on?
Well, I think that what you're seeing here is the rise of an alternative labor movement through worker centers and other nonprofit organizations that are not themselves unions. Some of them are affiliated with unions that are really empowering workers through training and especially, training workers and knowing what their rights are on the job. And a lot of these workers are undocumented. They don't realize that they do have certain labor rights in the United States. And so through this, once they gain this information and they have the support of these organizations, they're able to make demands for changes and better conditions in the workplace. And that's along with the fast food movement for $15 an hour and the way that has sort of exploded in the past few years. I think these are two real facets of the current wave of what does exist in the labor movement today, in spite of the decline of major unions.
What was the role of Occupy Wall Street in this story?
Well, Occupy Wall Street was actually our entry to the story. Rachel and I had been documenting Occupy Wall Street, and we heard about this group of workers because we heard they were reaching out to activists from Occupy for help in case they needed to occupy their deli. And it just sounded like an amazing story, and we wanted to get in on that and see what happened. But basically, the Occupy activists served the purpose of taking risks that the workers couldn't take. They were willing to get arrested. They were able to get arrested without possible deportation. So they offered to come in to the store at times when they were needed to do basically a sit-in and risk arrest. It became a real part of the story, just seeing the way that the organizers and the workers had to kind of negotiate the terms with these outside activists to make sure that they didn't kind of take over and make it all their own thing, but rather really pledge to put the workers in the leadership role, since they had so much to lose, since it wasn't just a game to them. It was very serious.
It was interesting to me to observe that dynamic, because what you have on the side of the Latino immigrant laborers is a lot of people who are middle-aged and a bit older and who are very vulnerable. And among the Occupy Wall Street, you have these people who are young and full of vim and vigor and by and large not Latino. And I was really impressed about how respectful the Occupy Wall Street people were.
Yeah, I think that was something that was really great for us to see. And there were a lot of, we were really glad to capture that. There were so many conversations that happened over the course of this campaign between the community support activists and the workers and the organizers about that issue, about what solidarity means. And the other thing, too, is that the group of supporters really was quite diverse. There was a range of ages. We weren't able to show everybody or really feature everybody in the film, but there was a range of ages and ethnic backgrounds. There were a few key players in that activist support network who were themselves Latino, and that facilitated, you know, some of them were able to speak Spanish as well, and there were some really interesting connections that got built over the course of this campaign between the workers and the various groups that supported them, not just Occupy. There were also student groups and other immigrant workers from other industries around the city who came to support on the picket line. And that broad-based community support was really crucial in keeping their morale up through such a long fight.
It turns out that the real old-fashioned, or what you think of as really old-school organizing techniques of picket lines and handing out flyers, are effective to this day. I mean, you see workers standing on the street corners handing out flyers, and almost nobody takes them, but actually it does work. What happened after they started doing this flyering outside of the restaurant?
Well, it's interesting. In the old days, you know, so much union activity was focusing on big manufacturing plants and that sort of thing, where you could really shut down the supply chain for a major corporation by going on strike. When you're working in a small deli, it's not so simple. But what you can do, the leverage that the workers were able to find was embarrassing them and sort of dirtying the name of the brand, you know, because the brand is the most valuable possession for a small restaurant. And the flyering that they did and the signs that they carried, you know, outside of these shops, it really brought down the owner's reputation in the neighborhood, and it scared them. And I think what you saw was they started negotiating pretty quickly with the workers, and when they couldn't break the union, in the end, they had to take some. Well, actually, I don't want to give away too much of the story for those who haven't seen it yet. But
now I know.
But it was a very effective technique to just reach out to the community and say, look, this is going on right under your noses. This place where you go to get your coffee has workers in the back who are not being treated fairly.
The whole film is just really an interesting study in what these folks are doing who, I mean, I'm sitting in a cafe right now and these people behind the counter are awesome. And you realize that if you're not one of them, you might not have the slightest idea of what their lives were like. And one thing I love about the film is you see how intelligent, good-natured, and strong these workers are who are organizing. I mean, they're wonderful people, and they're savvy. They don't believe the kind of, I mean, they see right through the kinds of tricks that the owners and investors are pulling. And I think it's one of the beautiful strengths of the film that you captured these people's lives and characters so beautifully.
Thank you. I mean, we were really trying to do that. You know, the main characters in the film are people that if you're just a customer and you don't work in a restaurant, and your main interaction with service workers is through buying a coffee or a sandwich, they can often remain invisible. You know, those of us that patronize any number of different types of locations are, we go in, we get what we want, and maybe we have a nice interaction, but we're unlikely to think too deeply about what the conditions are in the workplace or what the home lives of the people on the other side of the counter are like. That said, so many people from all walks of life do work in the food industry and food service at one point or another. You know, the low-wage economy is creating more of these types of jobs than many other types of jobs. And I think what we wanted to show was just whether you're a consumer or you have experience in this type of work, we really wanted to show the human side of what that experience is like and what can happen when a group of folks get together to challenge what are very common conditions in this industry.
And when you look at the big picture, it's a pretty ugly picture, and it appears that it's really become part of normal American business practice to steal from the poorest workers. This is what we're talking about here. We're talking about wage theft. We're talking about people who should be making the minimum wage, which is already not enough to live on. I think at the time of this film, I don't know if it's gone up, but in New York it was $7.25 an hour. And, I mean, who could live on that? But they would pay them less than $5 an hour. That is theft. That's as much theft as if somebody stole your wallet. And yet that's become the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's starting to change a little, and I think we're seeing a lot of signs of hope because of all the organizing that ordinary workers are doing. I mean, New York's minimum wage has gone up. Minimum wages are going up all over the country. But also things like wage theft, because of new laws, like the one in New York, the Wage Theft Prevention Act, that actually helped these workers launch a lawsuit that gave them a whole lot of it was a great tactic in their overall campaign to get a union. These laws are helping change things a bit, and I think there's a real pushback from a lot of people around the country that this is no longer acceptable, that you can't steal from workers, and you can't steal from the lowest paid workers like that.
Yeah, and I think that I'd like to mention, too, that that's a big part of what workers' centers do across the country, is really identify these locations where wage theft is happening, and it is incredibly widespread. And the combination of a lawsuit combined with pressure to change the prevailing conditions in the shop can be very powerful. And it's great to see that alongside the minimum wage, the living wage movement to raise the minimum wage, there is a lot more discussion of wage theft. It happens at the major chain, McDonald's, Wendy's, et cetera, as well, not just these small restaurants. It happens at full-service dining establishments. It's endemic in this sector, and there's been a lot more public attention to the issue in the last few years, and I think that is the ray of hope within the bleak situation of how widespread it is.
The film also really points out, without, I think, really saying it explicitly, but the immigrants who are working at Hot and Crusty, and we're talking about the film The Hand That Feeds, the immigrants who are working there, there's equivalents of them in almost every food service establishment in the entire city of New York, probably almost all or all of Santa Fe, New Mexico, where we're sitting, and virtually every city in the United States relies on these workers. It would shut down if they weren't working. And the idea that we're disparaging them instead of thanking them for their work and for basically keeping American business going is absurd. And yet that's the sort of political climate that we're living in.
Yeah. I hope people come away from watching the film with a sense of gratitude, because we lean on people in these jobs a lot, and they keep things going for us behind the scenes, so often invisible in the background. And I think, you know, these workers didn't want to remain invisible. They wanted people to know what was going on, and they put their trust in us as filmmakers to bring their story to the public. And we're really grateful that they did that, and we're really inspired by what they did.
The film is so suspenseful, and it's so interesting, and I was wondering if a lot of people have seen it. How are you getting it out there?
Well, we had a great run in festivals in 2014 and this year. We played in, I guess, maybe over 30, 35 festivals, a whole bunch of educational screenings, a lot of university screenings have happened. The film is available to university and public libraries through our educational distributor, Bullfrog Films. We did do an independent theatrical release in April in New York, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Detroit. So the film played for a week in each of those cities, 10 weeks in Detroit, actually. We did a ton of press around that, got some great reviews. And now we are just waiting for a date from PBS. We have PBS funding, so it will be somewhere on one of the PBS outlets at some point in the next few months or possibly next year. And after that, we'll be able to put it on the digital platforms as well. But right now, it's available through the types of screenings that are happening in Santa Fe, these semi-theatrical screenings where it'll play one night at a theater or at a community location. And we're encouraging people to get in touch with us through our website, thehandthatfeedsfilm.com. If anyone from a community group or educational institution or small theater wants to show it for one night or whatever they want to do, they're welcome to get in touch with us and we'll work it out.
Rachel Lears and Robin Blotnick are co-directors and producers of the film The Hand That Feeds. And once again, it's going to be screening at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. It's part of Somos Un Pueblo Unido's 20th anniversary film series called American Dreams, Border Realities. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And once again, the film is called The Hand That Feeds, and it's at thehandthatfeedsfilm.com. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.